to long term and speculation in science fiction. Again, with all these caveats, I would say the following. It's very easy for me to entertain a future where computers are increasingly smarter than we are along many, many dimensions. And that includes, for example, even today, right, when I want to do a mathematical computation, I'll do it via a calculator or via a computer program. My son, increasingly, when it comes to history and facts like population figures, just goes to our digital assistants, right? I train myself not to say Alexa or Google because we're always seem to be 3 feet away. Kissinger bemoaned the fact that you no longer have to remember and study all this historical background because it's so much available in our fingertips. That trend is going to accelerate. But intelligence and autonomy are very different things. I do think we need to protect our democracy and our rights as humans. And so the fact that there's going to be these machines that are phenomenal in various calculations, phenomenal in various cognitive tasks, doesn't mean that they get to take over. So I guess I've been called by Max Tegmark a wetware chauvinist. But I admit, you know, some of my best friends are humans, and I'd like to keep our human position sacrosanct.
And interestingly, Dr. Tegmark has started an organization looking at the ethics of AI as well in Cambridge. Any thoughts on that, Mark? And then I'm going to ask the big picture question here.
No, I'll pass.
No, you'll pass. Save the brain power for what's coming next. Well, when we brought you all out here, it was to answer this question, to explore this question, AI, where does it end? And we should make good on the title of this session. So I will ask that, where does it end? Because I wonder if this whole discussion will be moot once the AIs are inventing the AIs, and will we have an agreement on what good is? Will they inherit the human ethics at that point?
Well, so don't you think it's irrelevant? When the machines design their successors, then what's in those successors is what the machines find interesting to do.
Exactly. So the question for our guests here, the final big picture question is, AI, where does it end?
You know, Oren said, if we design these systems so that we control them, then we can retain control, even though they design better versions of themselves. But I think it's also really important that who's the we? It can't just be the technologists. Society has to be engaged, has to make policy, has to require scientists to put in the mechanisms that can implement the policy, right? We technologists shouldn't decide what fairness is. Society should decide.
Excellent. And that's one of the reasons that Mark is heading up this 20-year roadmap for the future of AI. So this is definitely on his mind. Oren, the big picture question, where does it end? AI's inventing other AIs and humans are redundant at best, extinct at worst?
For the foreseeable future, humans will be in charge, and as Mark said, society needs to make the value judgments. But as you're encouraging me to go beyond that, I apologize, but there's so much idle speculation on what happens beyond that, beyond the foreseeable horizon, and I'd like to paraphrase Dr. McCoy from Star Trek. I'm a scientist, damn it. I'm not a futurist or philosopher, so I will decline to speculate beyond the foreseeable horizon.
Or as Yogi Berra says, predictions are hard, especially about the future.
Well, thank you very much. So it looks like for now, humans still have some control and are the decision makers behind this technology.
This is the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences annual meeting in Seattle, Washington, and we want to thank our live audience for being here and still being cleverer than the machines.
The heading for the meeting is Envisioning Tomorrow's Earth, and I think we delivered on that promise here this morning. Thank you very much, Mark Hill, and also to Oren Etzioni. What a delight to speak to both of you. Thank you, and to everyone else.
Thank you.
Thank you to the guests who joined Seth and me on stage for this conversation about AI. Oren Etzioni is the CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence, and Mark Hill is professor of computer science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the chair of the Computing Community Consortium. This show was recorded at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in February 2020 in Seattle. Well, we gave an outline of the big picture, and it looks like that for now, humans will remain in the loop with AI, and we don't need to worry much?
Well, I don't know. I have to say that the comment that Oren Etzioni made about how people regarded him as kind of a champion of wetware, you know, the human brain over the machines, I mean, that was nice to hear. I just hope he's right. And he also said that sometimes when you see something clearly, you mistake it for being nearby. Right, which is to say, if you can see the machines taking over, that doesn't mean they're about to do it.
But to that question of how do we create ethical AI, it sounds like we need to be conscious of how we develop this technology. Don't just do it to fill a gap in the market or because there's demand or because we can. We need to be thinking about how we're developing this technology because it is powerful technology.
We've heard from both of these gentlemen that ethics is something they do consider. And, you know, whatever you think of the sincerity of that, it's a little different than the kind of inventiveness that was manifest, say, in the 19th and even the 20th century, where up until the time of the atomic bomb, you know, the people who were making the research didn't really worry too much about the ethics.
And as Mark Hill said, that even computer scientists 30 years ago weren't thinking about the ethics of what they were doing, but now they need to. And whether or not you think that AI researchers should take a Hippocratic Oath, whether or not that would make a difference, the fact that Oren Etzioni has suggested that we do that gives you a sense of how important that issue is to researchers or some researchers today.
Well, personally, I don't think that researchers are going to take a Hippocratic Oath or any other kind of oath, but they'll be judged by their research. But society will judge them, too. And if they're doing something that society perceives as either unethical or harmful in some other way, you know, they'll get that feedback. We'll see it happen.
Thank you to the exceptional intelligence of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producer Sarah Derwin, who were with us in Seattle. I am executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley.
Thanks also to financial support from Rena Shulsky David and Sammy David and to the William K. Bowes Jr. Foundation. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization whose scientists are using machine learning to better recognize signals that might betray extraterrestrial intelligence. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak. Also, a big thanks to our listeners.
This episode of Big Picture Science is AI. Where does it end? If you'd like to hear more Big Picture Science, well, you'll find past episodes in our archive at bigpicturescience.org, and you'll find links there to the guests you've heard as well.
You may be listening to our radio show over the airwaves, but you can also catch PiPiSci on the web by subscribing to the PiPiSci podcast. You'll find links on our website to the platforms that carry us.
There's chains of command everywhere, and people that are putting up money like to get what they think should be done. But, you know, I'm not going to sit around and waste my time just trying to fulfill a mandate like that when it's real to me that it's never going to get anywhere.
So in other words, put simply, a few times, you told him just to get screwed.
Well, I left SRI about five times.
Five times?
Over this issue. And I says, you know, I'd really rather go back to New York and write a novel and try to earn some money or something. You know? I'm an artist. I just as well take this time and paint.
Well, I once got fired by a boss six times.
Yeah.
So there you are. Ideas of your own. In other words, avenues of research that you wanted to pursue that they were not interested in. I would take it to mean that.
Well, in the early 70s, the only frames of reference that most people had for these kind of things were drawn from science fiction. Nobody sat around and read boring parapsychology periodicals and things like that. So they had these science fiction ideas, and that's what they were thinking they were working with. And I says, well, we have to change that right away. Mm. In fact, I once gave a presentation in a place I don't even think I should mention here, and say you can't get anywhere if you're going to think of this in terms of science fiction. You have to think of it in terms of real phenomena. And real phenomena are acting differently from what how these things are presented in science fiction. So,
did you scare the people you worked for?
Sure. I mean, I didn't set about to do that, but, you know, for instance, all through 1972 and 1973, people would come from Washington to talk with Puthoff, but they wouldn't want to talk with me. They wouldn't even have lunch with me because they were afraid I could read their minds.
Could you?
Well, sometimes. And I said, well, you know, what can I do about this? So I had to eat lunch alone. You know, I had to go to this little cheapo cafeteria while they sat in the dining room over there and talked about me.
Well, that's going to engender some resentment right there.
Well, I don't care. I mean, to hell with resentment, you know. You know, if there's going to be resentment, you know, everybody's supposed to row the same boat on a project, right?
Sure.
And if they don't do that, I'm going to go watch the grass grow somewhere.
Well, remote viewing, for example, finding a weapon system in a foreign country,
yes,
that's one thing. Drawing it, perhaps locating it, but sitting down at lunch or any other venue with somebody and essentially reading their mind, that's...
Oh, I mean, these chains of command are just terrified of telepathy. And, you know, I review that situation in my book, Penetration, which it's just, they're terrified of it. They don't want telepathy. And they're quite content to talk about it in a model of mind-to-mind thing that actually doesn't work. So they're, you know, and it's irrational, you know. I mean, most minds aren't worth reading to begin with.
Well, but it's not really irrational. In every science fiction movie I've seen in which telepathy was the subject, inevitably the telepaths were hunted down and killed like dogs.
Yes, but history has a history of doing just that.
Yeah, sure. Once we burned witches, and but I really can understand why that would be the reaction of somebody who would be terrified that you would be reading their inner thoughts. I mean, that is a terrifying thing for most
people.
Well,
it's not just their inner thoughts; it's their secrets.
Their secrets.
Their secrets. You know, and. It's just one of the realities out there as to why these... You see, the whole field of psychoenergetics has never been really researched, because if you permit research into it, if you give funding for it, our program at SRI was called psychoenergetics, because it was an energetics, studying the energetics of information transfer between things and people and so forth and so on. And people were so afraid of telepathy, I said to Puthoff, well, we can't use this word anymore, because, I mean, that's like waving a red flag before a bull. So we eliminated the word telepathy and a few other words, too. But, yes, I mean, if telepathy could be made functional, then everybody on this planet has a problem. And if it can be made functional between Earthlings and extraterrestrials, then you can. This is upsetting the entire Earth frame cultures.
Are you a natural telepath?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, yes, you do.
I don't really. I think that, you know, another book that I had self-published called Psychic Sexuality. I mean, people pick up sex vibes like mad from each other.
Uh-huh.
And this has never been researched, because it opens the door to the greater realm of psychoenergetics, you know. And it's just, no, I mean, if as long as there are secrets and preferred information and power structure that where the power is collected at the top and not distributed very fairly down throughout the rest of it.
Yeah.
These power structures don't want this, because, you know, power is probable not is, has enough problems.
If you introduce
telepathy into it, then it really becomes problematic.
Oh, yeah. The whole structure is supported by secrets.
Yep.
So we couldn't have an end to secrets, at least not and survive it. Secrets, deceit, and lies.
No, we could have secrets, but it simply means that they become accessible and could be used for proprietary access to formulas and places and what people are actually doing. You know, what people are actually doing at the top of these power structures has nothing to do with what the other people down below think is going on.
Do you still have to eat lunch alone a lot now?
Well, what was John Alexander's question again?
Well, it was, could they really have a double or triple black secret program without you?
Sure. I mean, they had them before me. They can have them after me.
Exactly.
Post-ingo.
So then, we should imagine it's certainly possible they have something going, and if they don't, then they're not paying proper, careful attention to national security.
That's right. Absolutely.
Now, why won't any of the other remote viewers say that? I mean, inevitably, almost to the one, they say, oh, no, there's no program going on now. Politics killed it. It was an embarrassment, all the rest of it. It's dead. I guarantee you there's nothing going on now. That's what they say. Do they lack imagination?
Well, as you know, I don't like to talk about other people.
Well, this is a general thing.
This is an issue, right?
Well, it is, yes.
People interpret reality from with their impersonal frames of reference. And if they don't have frames of reference that can incorporate this kind of thing, then that's how they function, you know. And if, for instance, you know, if they use the parapsychology frame of reference to try to understand these things, this is the wrong frame of reference. You have to use frames of reference that involve perception and receptors on the human body that receive different kinds of information and things like that. So this is a problem in perceptual information processing, and it has nothing to do with these few terms that have become popular but actually don't mean anything because they're the wrong frames of reference. So people that say these things, I'm very appreciative of the American genius that occupies a great part of these chains of command, you know. I mean, there are really some really smart people that are around. There are a lot of idiots, too, but there's lots of smart people working on these things, and I mean, you know, this is an area to be investigated, but the discoveries in it are so sensitive that the general public has to become convinced that there's nothing to it.
But it's the exact opposite, isn't it? I've got a lot of faxes here saying, you know, Art, I've really always wanted to know. I'm just not 100% convinced there is even such a phenomena as remote viewing. Is there any question whatsoever in your mind but that remote viewing is an absolutely true discipline, that it is real?
Well, I mean, that could be my personal opinion, but the evidence is that the SRI program was funded for 20 years, well, actually 18 years. And if there was no reality here, then that funding would have stopped the second year, right?
One would certainly think so, yes.
Oh, no, one has to know that. I mean, people don't run around and pour money into something that doesn't work. I mean, that's
our
whole system.
Wait a minute. Are you making that statement about our government?
Anybody.
That they don't pour money into things that don't work?
Right. If they know it doesn't work, then they don't pour money into it.
Well, I don't know about that, Ingo.
Well, I mean, things, you know, I know they pour millions of dollars into developing toilet seats and hammers and things like that.
That's right, they do.
But I'm not talking about that kind of thing. I'm talking about in 1973, you could lose your job and your status if you evinced a professional interest in ESP or psychokinesis, right?
Oh, sure.
It's not the same today, but back then that was it. And in fact, the greatest worry of the executives that took the decision to support our program was how they could cover their asses against this accusation of dealing in irrationality. So we had to produce the evidence that it worked right from the start. And it was only that evidence that can explain the long investment of the various agencies that kicked in money for it.
What do you think explains the sudden Nightline program and the revelation of the whole program to begin with? In other words, was this about to leak out anyway? Was there some threat that was looming that caused them to come forward and say, guess what we've been doing and now we're not doing it? What brought that on?
The CIA has only volunteered to go public on something three times in their history. And the discrediting of remote viewing was one time, and it was completely unexpected at that time.
Yeah, but they do everything for a reason.
Yes, but you have really to look into what those reasons might be, you know. And in my mind, anyway, one of those reasons was that they didn't want to ever have remote viewing connected with anything extraterrestrial. Because you put those two things together and you have a developing situation that these chains of command don't exactly know how to manage from the get-go, okay? So apparently the situation had gotten to a point where there were so many freedom of information inquiries and things like that those people took the extraordinary step of disclaiming it.
Are you telling me then that at some point in the program, and maybe you'd like to tell me at what point in the program, the people involved became aware of more than just terrestrial information?
Well, actually, I think it was Pat Price. You've heard of him, haven't you?
I've heard the name.
Yes, he was one of the early people that worked with Hal and sometimes with me. I think it was him who first enunciated the location of a... a human extraterrestrial cooperation base, something like that. And
Oh my, really?
Oh my, yes. And can you imagine the bells that started going off?
Oh, absolutely. A human extraterrestrial cooperation base.
Yes.
The location thereof.
I've told Pat Price, I don't think you should tell anybody about this.
Do you know where I live?
Pat Price was, yes, I know where you live.
You know where I live?
Was stubborn too, you know, and he went ahead and talked about those things, even unofficially, you know. And he had a good reputation, you know. He was a police officer. And
Would I regard that location as a neighbor?
No.
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 Is the location you're talking about still a matter, classified matter?
It's been, well, I mean, it never even got to the point where it needed to be classified. I mean, you can just wipe this away without even classifying it. That place is not there anymore. That I know.
Not there anymore?
No.
Are there other places that are there now?
Oh, yes. I mean, I've just finished reading two books. One of them is the Soul Catcher. Oh, The Catchers of Heaven.
Yes.
By one Michael Wolff, who is talking about them like mad.
Uh-huh.
In his book. And
Ingo, hold it right there. We're at a break point. Listen, everybody. Ingo has written a whole bunch of books that you're going to want to read about. On my website, we've got links to his books. Go up there, www.artbell. Scroll down to the name Ingo Swann and read.
Take a ride. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to call Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nine. So if you can't please understand,
you might not come back. I wonder if that's true, that you might not come back. Good morning, everybody. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. My guest is a rare bird. He's Ingo Swann, thought to be one of the greatest naturals who's ever lived. We'll get right back to him. Well, all right, back now to Ingo Swann. After that last little bombshell, I would like to ask Ingo just exactly how much do you know about human extraterrestrial intercourse, intellectual or otherwise?
Well, 50% of what I know is I put in my book, Penetration,
Extraterrestrial Penetration, isn't it?
That's what secrecy is all about, man, you know? Keep it from being penetrated.
This is your latest book?
No, I had written a number of books which no publisher would touch with a 10-foot pole, you know. So eventually I decided to publish them myself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think the things that I've experienced and learned, I should put them in print somewhere, so.
And your latest book, is it self-published as well?
Yes, Penetration is self-published. I went ahead and did the psychic sexuality book too, because this is another, I mean, it's very hard for you to think that anything can be covered up about sexuality.
I know,
but indeed it can. And it was a good way to show how the entire field of energetics is covered up too. So I published that one too.
All right, then give us just a sort of a 101 on human ET contact. Is it extensive? Has it been going on a long time? Are there a lot of bases? People have a lot of questions about this, Ingo.
Yes, I know they do. The only thing I can do is, many years ago when I was working at the United Nations, I came across a book called Spacemen in the Ancient East. And I wrote to the author, who's, I'm sure, deceased by now, and carried on a correspondence with him, you know, and he had tracked the historical story of ETs coming to Earth. And then he wrote a book called Ancient Astronauts in the West.
Yes.
Ancient Astronauts in Israel. And, it just went on and on and on. And I said, good heavens, you know. And the thing about this book is that this guy learned 9 languages in order to read original texts and things like that. And he gave the references. So I checked out some of the references, and they were there, you know. So this is a well-researched document. He couldn't get his books published in the United States. He got to be quite famous in England and in Europe, and especially in Italy for some reason. But there was one version of Spaceman in the Ancient East published here in the United States, and then after that, no publisher would take his books on, and he wrote about 10 of them. So, you know, I said, well, why is it that these books won't get published in America?
Mm-hmm.
And at the bottom line, they're just too revealing, right? I mean, you know, they say the right things. They do the right history. They document it and everything like that. So I says, well, there's some kind of cover-up going on here, you know. I mean, powerful people do have control of book publishers. And so that started me off in the 60s on this kind of interest. And That was before I started doing experiments in laboratories on ESP and PK and things like that.
First-hand knowledge in this area, Ingo?
Yes, I do. It's really strange.
That's okay. This is the home of strange.
This is the home of strange.
Yeah.
Well, in 1975, I found myself invited into a very strange remote viewing thing, and the whole story of that is the first part of my book, Penetration. And it turned out this was really, really strange, the way it went about and things, but it turned out that the guy involved was very obviously part of a larger system having deep concern in extraterrestrial matters. He wanted me to remote view certain locations on the moon, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. And then he kept asking, while we were doing this, it took about 3 days in an underground installation somewhere. It took about 3 days, and he kept introducing the topic of telepathy as an "oh, by the way" type of thing. And so finally, I can be really naive in some time. And it took me about 48 hours to say, this guy's not interested in remote viewing. He already knows what's on the moon. He's interested in the telepathic thing, you know. And so I said, come on. You guys have a problem, a telepathic problem with ETs, don't you? And, of course, that blew the cool of everybody. I had promised not to talk about this for 10 years.
For 10 years?
No paper trail of this project and anything. But what had happened was I briefly got on the inside of this super-duper secret thing of dealing with ETs. And it turns out I didn't play my cards right. If I had have played my cards better, I could have probably been taken into the whole thing and become a lifetime project, you know.
What is on the moon, Ingo?
Stuff. And them.
Their stuff.
It's not our stuff.
Well, there has been, when you think about the U.S. space program.
Yes.
The manned space program, particularly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Over 30 years ago, we went to the moon, and we've never gone back.
That's right.
Nor have we gone anywhere else with men.
That's right.
And a lot of people have been really curious about that, and I know they talk about money, and they talk about a lot of other things. And I've interviewed a lot of astronauts, Ingo, and when you ask them about their time on the moon, walking on the moon, they give you really strange answers. Like, you know, they'll say, well, you know, it's funny, but when I think about it, the entire experience was surreal. And we've asked specific questions about, like, did you see this or did you see that? And there's sort of a stutter-stop hesitation. And they'll say, no, but it could have been there and I could have not seen it. I was in such
really?
A...
Did they go that far?
Yeah. Yes.
I've never heard anyone go that far.
Yes, well, I have.
Well, you're on the pulse of things, and I'm not.
Even people like Neil Armstrong, you know, the first guy to set foot on, has made some very intriguing statements with regard to what could be ahead of us, the fantastic things that could be ahead of us. And I don't think he's talking about the International Space Station. He actually did that at the White House. So, and then, of course, we have the fact that all of these astronauts, or the great majority of them, actually, have come to real problems, psychological, drinking, domestic problems, all kinds of problems that one might imagine could be precipitated by trying to hold on to information that they don't really want to hold on to. Speculation, but not bad.
Well, I think that they're in a place that is really difficult.
Mm.
Let's say if there's stuff on the moon that isn't ours, then there is a real problem. And I think that the best way to handle that problem is just to put out a public type of program that says nothing at all about anything.
Well, they've done that.
Yeah, they've done that. No, they didn't go back to the moon after a certain point. In fact, they left three fully developed manned landing things on the pads and never used them. They were set to go, and they never used the last three of them. Did you know that?
I did not know that specifically. No, I didn't.
Well, it's in my book. Everything is in my book.
In other words, I
shouldn't say everything, but things like that are in my book, you know. I mean,
all right,
when you put the pieces together, you come up with a story, right?
That's right.
Okay. So the way to not come up with a story is to prevent the pieces from being put together.
I love reading between the lines, and boy, you sure have lots of good reading between those lines for us. To get your book or any of your book, by the way, what would you recommend as a first book for people to read? What would you like to have them read right now?
Well, I only have two available, and I think they should read both of them because actually they're on totally different topics, but the thing, they're interrelated. The first one is called Penetration, the Question of Extraterrestrial and Human Telepathy, and the second one is called Psychic Sexuality, the Biopsychic Anatomy of Sexual Energies, and they both cost $18.95.
All right. I've got the phone numbers,
right.
So let me give them out. Are these phone numbers that I'm about to give out, getting pencil, I hope, everybody in paper, are these phone numbers day and night or just day or what?
Well, right now they're being manned.
Oh, operators are sitting around and waiting.
Sitting, yes, well, and they're both toll-free.
Well, then let's make them earn their money. So if you would like either one of these books, folks, you can call one of two toll-free numbers. One is 888-453-4046. That's 888-453-4046 or 877-565-8391. That's 877-565-8391. If one is busy, try the other. And you might want to grab actually both.
You're listening to the last recording of Art Bell interviewing Ingo Swann about secrets of UFOs, aliens,
for
and paranormal.
In Monarch Butterfly.
Yes, there you are. That's a vexed question. I mean, initially it was thought to be very straightforward, and the answer was yes. But scientists who've looked at it since have at least raised some question about whether there's something that happens to the monarchs that render them infertile.
Uh-huh.
It's just not known. But even if it's not known, though, I think everybody is well aware of the fact